Tamar Mohasia. It's a little bit complicated name. Not as complicated as my name. Nevertheless, Mutama Mwasia. And Mutama is of Kenyan origin. He did his undergraduate studies at Moi University in Kenya and did an MPhil in Kenya as well. Thereafter, he went to the UK and completed a PhD at the University of Reading. And that was done in 1998. And after that, he did 3 stints of postdoctoral research. So he's quite an internationally traveled research person. And he did work at the Royal Botanical Gardens in Kew. I'm sure you know about that.
Yeah.
And he did a postdoc at Rutgers University, and thereafter at the University of Leuven in Belgium. So he's got 3 postdocs under his belt, and then he came to UCT in 2006 and was appointed as senior lecturer. And just last year, Mutama was promoted as associate professor. And Mutama, is this your first lecture as associate professor? Yes.
Thank you very much, Anusia. It's such a privilege to have students like you turn up early in time, hour awake, and not playing your gadgets. My typical class week, first years especially, the 300 of them, half of them don't turn up. And the other half will turn up, spend more time chatting, giggling, having their lunch, and all that kind of thing. But then that puts pressure on me that I have to make sure that by the end of my 40 minutes with you, you have a take home on the wonderful biodiversity we have, and that I would have communicated 1 or 2 things and maybe taken away some of the myths that are still persisting in literature, especially in relation to the links between Africa, Australia, you know, famous here, famous in Australia, and such. My focus will be mostly on the savannas, partly because I grew up in the savannas east of Kenya, you know, at about 1,000 meters above sea level, where, you know, in my childhood, while not in school, while herding goats and eating wild fruits, my vegetation was mainly acacia woodlands. And then within an hour's drive, you can get on the lower slopes of Mount Kenya. And those lower slopes have got mountain forest. It's almost similar to going up Kassimbosh and going up Skeleton Gorge. And within 3 hours hike, you come into this belt, which has got plants of European descent. But also you get ericas there, you get gladiolus, things that we know from the Cape. And actually, my coming to the Cape in 97 as a PhD student was coming to Rondebosch Common to collect Isolepis, which is one of those tiny cypraceae. But Isolepis, on each of the African mountains, there is a species which has evolved on those mountains. And as a systematist, my research is on the phase between, or from discovering and describing biodiversity. So yesterday there was a question with Jeremy on what is a species for plants, and I almost jumped in to say species concepts are varied depending on the groups you're working with, but for plants, I recognize species if I can see a break in the morphology. And there are people who say you may not have morphological differences, but you can find genetic differences, or you can find geographical differences, then maybe you should still recognize a species. And recognize that a species is not a fixed entity, but is in a continuum. And so if you deal with animals, especially the big animals, reproduction seems to be the main criterion. But for plants, you easily can take a plant from Table Mountain and one from Amanas, different genera, and they'll interbreed, even though they are morphologically different, and even though they are occurring in different habitats. So that's for background. But when one moves from the species level to the ecosystem level, you find that there is an amazing order in how plant groups are placed currently. So, this one, we are in the Cape, where we've got fynbos in a Mediterranean type climate, but our plants here are more similar to the plants in the Mediterranean system in Europe or in Australia. Our plants are so different from the plants that we find in the savannas, yet there's a short distance. And the current paradigm is that it's easier to disperse long distances to the habitat that you evolved and adapted to than to evolve adaptation to to a nearby but strikingly different habitat. So, you know, if you think about the weeds that we have in the Cape, all the annual grasses are coming from Mediterranean Europe. If you think about the acacias that we're having, it's not the acacia which is coming from Pumalanga, it's the acacia coming from Australia. And once you have adapted to a particular niche, you are more likely to track it. And so my talk today will focus on the savannas. And the savannas, you know, everyone thinks of the savannas, thinks about, you know, the Serengeti or the Kruger. But that system is what we see today. If you step back 10 million years ago, how was it? If you step back 50 million years ago, how was it? What about 65 million years ago when the dinosaurs were roaming in Africa? And there has been quite tremendous changes in terms of millions of years, that what we're seeing today is tips within a tall or big evolutionary tree where as climate changes, there's room for evolution, for adaptation, and species which cannot adapt to the current climate get extinct, and ones which can fill the emerging habitats come up. So as part of my talk also, I want to just, you have in back at your mind, or with climate change, with, you know, more carbon dioxide being pumped in the air, what's the future of those species which are evolved, or those habitats of vegetation types which evolved in low carbon dioxide scenario? That's just for introduction. We live in an exciting time as evolutionary biologists, because in the last 20 years or so, we've got new tools which were not available to our predecessors. Use of DNA data has become commonplace, and there is huge data sets which have been collected, and those data sets are collected across different organisms using the same kind of marker or the DNA barcode, such that, you know, I can be working in the Cape, but I can tap onto an international data set or database, and I can put my Cape plants in the context of a global database. At the same time, in the last 20 years, we have huge progress in computational power. I'm sure in most of your careers, the biggest computer you dealt with was a handheld calculator or those machines that you had. But now, you know, the cell phone is a stronger computer than the computer we had 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And that has allowed analysis of the biological data with environmental data to get interpretations which are not available. And so we are in an era, I would say, of exciting comparative biology, where you can look from genes to species to ecosystems. In the current scenario of climate, you can look at them in the future scenario if you want to ask, you know, if temperatures increase by 1 degree, what does it mean to that species which is roundabout common? And you can model where the niches that will be available for it. I'll be having such trees in my talk, and I would like to give you just how to think about them. Think of this as a tree, just turn it over, and it's a big tree of mammals which have got hooves. And within this, you can say that, you know, any 2 points are the closest relatives. So Jeremy's talk yesterday, we were talking about Riparia, Ripens, and the other Riparia. They are sister species, they are their closest relatives. But then in this tree, which has got the hippo there, hippo's closest relatives are things like whales and dolphins. And those are sister to a group which includes pigs down here, or zebra down here. And so on this tree, you know, from the root being the common ancestor 3 billion years ago, to the common ancestor of all mammals, maybe 50 billion years ago, to the common ancestor of the dolphin and the whale, maybe 20 billion years ago. It's like climbing a big tree and looking at different layers. And as we look at this evolutionary tree, we have to accept that there's been extinctions. And so what you might be dealing with is our tips of a branch which is fairly big, and many of the branches have been eliminated in time. So tree thinking is the main way we're thinking about interpreting the biodiversity we have on Earth. I'm a taxonomist by training. I've named species, I've changed names of species, and I know many people are very uncomfortable with name changes.
Yes.
But name changes are inevitable especially when we want to reflect this tree of life. Because you don't want, if you looked at dolphins and whales, and you used just the ability to swim, you could put them together with fishes. Yet when you look at their DNA and their skeletons and other traits, you find they are closest to hippo. And so the most recent and famous one is the case of acacia, where the taxon we call acacia, our taxon I call acacia growing in East African savannas, with thorns, with big pods. I struggle to see how it is related to the Australian thing we call acacia. But then when you look at what the name acacia had been applied, it had been applied to entities, plant groups, which were fairly large, just like applying the whole root to be acacia, but then also it included members of another branch because they shared morphology. And we've got acacias in Africa, we've got acacias in Australia, we've got acacias in South America. And in a way to reconcile, to have a name only applying to members, descendants from only one branch, there was need to cut acacia into at least three different things. Taxonomic principle says that the type species for the genus should retain the name. And the type species for acacia is African. But you know, democracy. Democracy is what? At the International Botanical Congress in Vienna in 2005, I was present, and one in Melbourne in 2011, democracy was applied. And the Australians put the case that what they call acacia is about 2,000 species, economically important, etc., etc. And they had more voting members. The type is African. There was just a handful of us, and you know, you had a vote as an institution, you had a vote as an individual member of the society, and democracy just made a mockery of itself. And the name was now conserved for the Australian, and in Africa, we are forced to take other older names. At the end of the day, what's in the name? I call them acacia. But yesterday there was a question on the age of lineages. And you know, when we are looking at the tips, it's difficult to think where they evolved. But when you're in the fynbos and you're encountering ericas, you're encountering proteas, you're encountering asphaltas, one could assume that they have always been here for millions of years. Until people who work on fossils tell you that in the West Coast, there was a tropical forest. And Anusia, I think, mentioned this in our talk. In the context of when there was a tropical forest, there were no ericas. There were, you know, trees which you have in the savannah. There were palms. And so we can use molecular data and fossil data and estimate the age at which different branches evolved. And when we use that method, we find that what we call as flowering plants, plants which have seeds and flowers, only evolved in the last 200 million years. And actually, the bulk of them have evolved in the last 100 million years. And I'll be referring to ages a lot more, and what many of the taxa we see in the Cape actually have evolved in the last 20 million years. The geologists in the audience will tell me that Africa and Australia were connected. But they were connected 100 million years ago. And by 65 million years ago, Australia was already in its current position. So what we see are tips which have evolved long after the continents were separated. And so there has been long distance dispersal as opposed to things evolving when the continents were together. I know that it's in literature. I see it in the Fan Kloof Nature Reserve Advisory Board, and one of our signposts says Australia and Africa proteas because of the continents being linked. We still need to revise some of these things to make it current. Now, there's also, in literature, in common speak, there's talk of fossil plants or fossil animals. And Dinko is a classical example where if you look at fossil from Jurassic, from 150 million years ago, it's got impressions of the same kind of leaf as we have for the current Dinko. And if we look at Dinko as a lineage, it seems to be species poor. So perhaps we're having remnants from a branch which is fairly old. On the other hand, when we think about cycads, cycads also are said to be living fossils, but Encephalatus and Zamia split about 30 million years ago. So the cycad, which is sitting in the groove in Kassenbosch, evolved recently. It's retained morphology from its ancestor, but it's not a fossil taxon. So to the bulk of my talk, I'll focus on the savannas. I'll tell you why it's important. I think it's a fascinating system in the sense that in discovering huge parts of Africa, you've got adaptations for the dry, arid conditions. You've got adaptations to fire. And it's maintained by an interaction of fire, herbivore, and climate. And I also hope to have some time to talk about the Cape. So I don't see if I get sidetracked. Keep my foot on something.
I'll tell you that.
If you think about the savannah, Serengeti, with huge, huge numbers of mega herbivores, comes into mind. But also there's an acacia there. So it's a system defined by having grasses, and many of these grasses use a particular kind of photosynthetic system called the C4 photosynthesis, and I'll talk more about it. It's defined by presence of herbivores which eat the grass, and this grass has adapted to be eaten down and to regrow after the rains, hence the migrations you get from Serengeti to Masai Mara as a rain belt moves. But also in some savanna systems, fire is the main driver. So you mean the high veld around the Lidlberg and such areas. Fire happens fairly frequently. And while we see fire, we think, oh, stop it. There are species which have adapted and evolved into respond to frequent fires. Based on the rainfall, savannas can be separated into arid or mesic savanna. And since the cutoff is about 600 to 700 millimeters per year, if you have less than 600 to 700 millimeters per year, then fire is not common. And it's already to which limits or determines who grows. If it's more wetter, then fires become common and species which have evolved to fire are more prevalent. If you look at the map of Africa, we find that huge parts of Africa, other than the west equatorial part, which has got rainforest, the Sahara, which is a desert, or the southwestern Cape, which has got the Namib and the winter rainfall Mediterranean system, a huge part of Africa has got savannas. And these are either arid, the more gray ones, or they are mesic, where you've got the hashes. If we look at, I say C4 grasses are the main characteristic grass in savannas. If you look at where C4 grasslands occur, and this heat map, increasing red is the dominance of C4 grasses, we find that the same belt that we're saying has got either arid or mesic savannas is also having C4 grasses. But C4 grasses are also in Brazil, in the Cerrado system, they're in North America, Europe, and even Australia. When do they arise? And can we use them to answer the question on when these grasslands that characterize the savannas evolved? This is a slide which, for those who just want to know more about C3 and C4 photosynthesis, in photosynthesis, plants are able to combine carbon dioxide and water to make glucose. And that product in most plants has got three carbon structure, hence called C3. However, in the grasses that we have in the savannas, they have a C4 photosynthetic system where they have specialized cells around the veins which do the photosynthesis. And carbon dioxide diffusing through the stomata gets captured and fixed into an enzyme. And that enzyme is actively transported to the point at which photosynthesis is taking place. So it's both physiological adaptation, but also anatomical adaptation. And C4 photosynthesis is thought to have evolved at a time when carbon dioxide was fairly low in the atmosphere. From about 25 million years ago or so, carbon dioxide levels decreased such that plants which were using C3 photosynthesis, where you require carbon dioxide to diffuse for photosynthesis to take place, could not as efficiently fix carbon. And especially in areas with high temperature, with high aridity, you need to have your stomata open for long, but the longer you open them, the more you lose water. So if you can be able to take carbon dioxide and actively fix it without losing, opening your stomata too long, then you are at an advantage. If you look at amount of rainfall and amount of temperature, you find that there's a trade-off. If the temperatures are very high, if you are C4, you have an advantage. However, as the temperatures drop, and this is minimum temperature, you are at a disadvantage if you are C4, as you get more C3 system. So if you're in the Cape and you look at the grasses that we have, they are mostly using the C3 system, except for the weeds that we have on the roads, and except for Kikuyu grass, which comes from East Africa. So we've got C4 plants which are coming in habitats which we are disturbing, where there's constant mowing of the grass, or where there's wash off from rain, or in wetlands which have had more nutrients put in. But there's a strong temperature link, there's a rainfall link, and also there's a carbon dioxide link, such that at a given growing temperature, you find that at different levels of carbon dioxide, there's a balance and a switch from C3 to C4. And this is something that, as we think about the future, we need to be aware of, because our C4 grasses, which includes most of our crops, the maize, the sorghum, the sugarcane, evolved at a time when carbon dioxide was low. As we pump more and more carbon dioxide in the air, those crops might not be at an advantage. So we need to rethink about our diets. We need to include more C3, maybe woody species, more cassava, more sweet potatoes into our diet. These are things that, as we think about food security in the future, we have to grapple with. We're also getting super weeds, and you know, with changing landscape, this pericetum, which is related to sorghum, seems to be one of the winners in a changing landscape. You know, you see it on the N7 as you drive to Springbok. It's a huge problem in America, and maybe in Australia also. But what is the evidence of C4 plants other than me standing as fertility? People who work on fossil data have been able to find increases in carbon 13 signature. C4 plants, for some reason, are able to fix one kind of carbon more than C3 plants. And the ratio of carbon 12 to carbon 13 varies. And so, if you look at the tooth enamel of animals who have been eating C4 plants, I like my pap. I like my sugarcane. I like my teeth sweet. So perhaps if you look at my teeth, they'll show more evidence of carbon 13 isotope than somebody growing up in South America where they're having potatoes and perhaps having other kinds of sugar. And animals from fossils have been shown to have, from about 10 million years ago, is when carbon 13 is evident in their teeth. The same is in soils, because when grasses fragment or when plants fragment, they get incorporated in the soil. There's also a shift in carbon 13 in the soils, and also in the charcoal, which gets blown into the ocean after fires. You know, you think of West Africa and all the water soils or winds blowing from the Sahara into even South America. They bring dust and plant material, and by making a core in the ocean, you can be able to fix signature of what kind of vegetation was there.
Sorry, I wonder if you could just go back there.
Sorry?
Could you go back there a moment? Well, what is the scale at the bottom? The jug is in the way, I can't quite see the scale.
What is that?
Scale.
Is time in million years.
Okay.
And unfortunately, in scientific literature, million years ago seems to be abbreviated differently. Some of my slides only have M for million years ago, others will have MA, others will have MYA, but it's million years. Thank you for pointing that. So, from about 10 million years, there's signature in the tooth enamel, there's signature in the soil, there's signature in charcoal for increase in C4 isotope. And if one thinks of it, now, what happened? Those 10 million years, what were those grasslands replacing? And, you know, from about 60 million years ago, much of Africa and other continents had forests. And these grasses which were there at that point, grasses had already evolved by 60 million years, but they were either sitting in forest. So we have the earlier images of grasses are sitting in forests in West Africa or in South America. And one of the sister to grasses, Flageraria, sits in the forest from Pondoland all the way to Malindi, coastal African forest. I've got one of the largest of grasses. But so grasses evolved to occupy forest or to occupy wetlands, patches within forest. But as about 25 million years ago, as the climate became warmer, as carbon dioxide dropped, grasses expanded. And so with that expansion, we find that C4 lineages of grasses, which are called C4 lentices, have an expanded burst of evolution. And it's from those that then the signature starts coming out. So this is from Mediterranean, from China, from North America, Pakistan, from Kenya, where there's all overwhelmingly shift from green, which is forest, to yellow, which is open, and then C4 into the enamel are the red dots. In Argentina, however, it's a different story. C4 grasses or graminoids evolved in an open environment. So it's not all from a closed forest system that C4 evolved. I use the term graminoids to represent grasses and sedges. Poaceae, Cyperaceae, the two families which have got contribute to about 80% of the C4 fluorescence. This is a study that I was involved in where we looked at the genetic level, and because C4 fluorescence has evolved in both dicots and in monocots. You know, when you think about our sugar beet, that lineage with the sugar beet has got C4 fluorescence. And within the graminoids, we find that there are at least 24 or 23 events of independent evolution of C4 fluorescence. And that has happened by mutations happening, and for amino acids, at least at 5 positions, converging to the same amino acids. So it's mutations to maximize capturing carbon dioxide into an enzyme, and it has happened independently at least 23 times among the graminoids. And if we put an age to those 24 events, we find that majority of them, the crown age being the part of the branch which has got all the best of species, we find that most of them are occurring after 15 million years. And especially for the main lineages which are in our mesic grasslands, if you go to the Heifeld, the Panicums, or the Cyperas, all have got an age of about 8.4 million years. So at a molecular level, we find a confirmation of the data that we find from fossil that C4 lineages are fairly young. I think the savannas also include animals and antelopes. These are an evolutionary tree of ungulates, and of those, if you look at the antelope group, Antilopini, they also have an age of about 10 million years. So as the grasslands opened, we also have co-evolution of animals, and the main animals that we associate with the savanna, the antelopes and such, evolved after the grasslands opened. I know when one looks at the distribution of animals today, because of our management practices, it's very skewed. You know, we always associate the elephant with Kruger, the buffalo with the Kruger. But I can tell you, I've been chased by an elephant on Mount Kenya at 3,000 meters. And buffalo seem to be happily running up and down these slopes. So they must not have evolved in a system which is open. But, you know, the antelopes mostly are restricted to habitats which are open, and they evolved with the grasses. I have spent some time in Madagascar with my colleagues, and when we talk about fires in Madagascar, people go, humans. Last 500 years when humans have occupied Madagascar is when those grasslands have evolved. You go to them, and yes, if there's persistent burning, you get a shift to only one or two species of grasses. However, if you look at them, they only evolved in Madagascar. So, in wet systems, you get alternative stable states where you can have forests in habitats which are protected from fire, and you have grasslands. And within, if we looked at Madagascar, we look at the grasses that are in those grasslands that have evolved there. Other plants woody plants which are in the grasslands also are involved there, and the forests also have got their unique taxa. And this is a question that is part of our ongoing research, asking the question on, you know, especially when you look at my next slide, which is on African Adderall forest, species of trees which belong to branches which have got tree ancestors or tree form, and then you have evolution to this thing, which is only up to 30 centimeters tall, and unrestricted grasslands which have got fire or have got frost or have got seasonal waterlogging. But just before I come to African story, I'll take you to Brazil, where in the Cerrado system, we've got members of the acacia group, mimosoids, which have either thick bark or have got sufrutex, where you've got short shoot coming above ground, but much of the woody material below ground. And this molecular tree for those legumes show that at about 10 million years is when all those lineages with fire-adapted trees have evolved. So the grasslands of Brazil have evolved in the last 10 million years. They've got frequent fires, and they've got species which have got either thick bark or have gone the underground route to escape the fire. When we look at fire, and this is from a paper showing satellite images of fires in Southern Africa in the last 10 million years, you find that the fires are most frequent in that belt that you've got the savannas. Also, fires are in the fynbos, so it's not just in the savanna, but they are mostly in the savanna system. You go into those grasslands, and you find what is just a small herb, or looks like a herb with a few centimeters above ground, has huge investment below ground. And these are the species that have got that burst flowering immediately after fire. Welcome to the African underground forest. You know Erythrina. These are Erythrina abyssinica, but you've got other Erythrina species, Kafra and such, growing around. And here is Erythrina zieri, which is in the high veld. Above ground, 30 centimeters, will have a shoot, seasonal shoot, with a flower and fruit of the same size as its relative, but that's a below ground structure. Huge below ground investment. And this morphology is in at least 30 different images. And we were curious that the term African underground forest was coined by a Oxford professor, Frank White, in the 80s. And he listed a number of species and he mapped where they occurred. And now using molecular data in a collaboration tool with a team from UJ and UCT and Canada, we set to ask the question, when did these African lineages evolve? So what did we do? We took the DNA barcode marker and we did it in the context of woody species of Southern Africa. Over 1,000 species sampled, representing the whole tree of life. And then of these, we included especially taxa where there is a sufrutex taxon, like in Gardenia here. You're familiar with Gardenia in Kirstenbosch. Huge beings, big fruits, members of the coffee family. That's a sufrutex member of the Gardenia. These are protea, and that's a sufrutex protea in the grasslands. That's Cusonia, and that's the sufrutex member of Cusonia. And we support these and put it on our phylogeny, or on our tree of life, and we find that this morphology shown in red has evolved at different points within this tree. But if you look at the age, it's mostly in the last 10 million years. We've got a couple of older taxa, especially among the coffee members of the coffee family. So, but majority of the species or lineages, or branches of the tree of life which has got the underground forest, it's evolved in the last 10 million years. That's the same time that the grasslands have evolved. So we believe that here we're dating the age of fire, in our grasslands. If we look at where those fruitcakes occur on the map of Africa, and in this heat map, red is the oldest lineages, blue is the youngest, we find that there are more older fruitcakes along the coast of Africa and also near the equator. And as you come further south, that is Swaziland there, in the high veld, we've got younger lineages. So we cannot say that these underground forests are of the same age. But what we can say is that they all seem to occur in areas where fire is prevalent, and that it's a complex, perhaps multiple trigger evolution, where in the Eifel you've got more frost and fire. In Zambia and Zimbabwe, you've got the Nyombo woodlands, which have got seasonal waterlogging. Whereas fire perhaps is more prevalent on the coastal system. Why is it important to study these savannas? Why is it important to study their evolution? You know, people working on fossils, I started my career at the National Museums of Kenya, where the Likis have done much of the work on the hominids. And the Turkana boy, which is one of the most best preserved fossil of an hominid, is thought to have been what, about 1.5 million years ago. And that's the vegetation setup that the hypothesis evolved in. Can we be able to test those hypotheses on under what scenario the hominids have evolved? Also, if we look at grassland, forest as alternative states, if we say that the Eifel could become forested, and there's evidence that there's more and more bush encroachment in grasslands, can we be able to put scenarios to say if carbon dioxide goes above this level, then we will lose our savanna or grassland species? And there are experiments going on, experimenting on carbon dioxide levels, and this scary data that as you increase carbon dioxide, what looks like a little plant has huge underground investment. What about food security? No. Sorghum, staple food for Africa. Maize, staple food. Increase carbon dioxide, bring more aridity, then we're dealing with less food, perhaps we're dealing with super weeds. So it's a question that, even though I'm approaching it from as a biologist, I've also got to think about other aspects of society. And just, those are members of the team, Professor William Board, that many of you might know, who has been in our department, members from University of Johannesburg, from Canada, and so it's a, and John and Sandy Barrows from the Bofors Kloof Aquarium, who have hosted us and are part of the team. So that's the first part of my talk. I still can go on to the cave now. Just to recap, that's the vegetation map of Africa, and we've got a Mediterranean system at the southernmost tip, and we've got a Mediterranean system at the north. And the question that I want us to ask ourselves is, when did our Mediterranean system arise? The Cape, as you know, is an area, the greater Cape region, including all the winter rainfall area from PE to Springbok and such, it's a biodiversity hotspot. You know, 70% of the plants are there, are only found here, of 13,000. That's a huge number of species. You know, in the peninsula, we've got more species than in the British Isles. And to have huge endemism, species that are only here, is phenomenal. But that diversity in plants doesn't seem to be matched by animals. So fishes are fewer, but also with high endemism, reptiles not as high, bees, we still need a lot of workers to get a picture. So where we have made strides to study the plants, the animal side must not have matched in the studies. That's a photo taken from the fossil deposits in the West Coast. And you know, you see here short-necked giraffe, elephants, palm trees, and visiting that fossil park and seeing these fossils, you almost think, well, these guys making models are just playing with us, placing things that are more of imagination. How can you, where your fynbos, have such? But then, further north, people working on cores in the ocean have been able to dig and to look at pollen deposit. And from that pollen deposit, there's evidence that before 10 million years, there's pollen grain which matches the pollen grain of palm trees. The palm pollen is also occurring with trees, tree species like Dodonea, like Balanitis, like Welwitschia. So trees that we associate with more tropical systems are in the same fossil deposit as the palm from the West Coast. Now, what we think about as fynbos, Erica. Erica pollen only comes in after 10 million years. That's the part for Erica. If you think about the succulent Karoo and all the mesms, Also, they come in maybe 7 million years. And when you think about the rhinoceros, in the rhinoceros, Elatropapos only comes in the last 5 million years. So, data from fossils shows a shift in vegetation. But can we see a signature of this shift from the molecular data? And there has been a hypothesis that, you know, on this figure, that there has been a change in fynbos cover increasing from 10 million years, and that has been associated with increased aridification, with shift in ocean currents due to the Benguela current, and exposure of the limestones in the Agalas Plain in the last 3 million years. So there has been both climatic and geological changes which have happened in the part where we have fynbos, and these are thought to have been linked with the shift from a tropical system to a Mediterranean system. Now, in a study which looked at quite a number of lineages, different families that are found in the fynbos, and starting from restios to grasses to pelargonium to orchids, and we find that lineages which are in blue, which are the ones which are in the fynbos, and the ones in the yellowish color, which are in the succulent Karoo, we find that majority of the lineages in the fynbos are young, but there are a couple which are older. So restios seem to predate the Mediterranean system. The same with the grass Ehata, which we find both in the succulent Karoo and in the fynbos. However, if you look at orchids, Satyrium, it's all fairly young. And now more data, attended a talk conference 2 weeks ago where there was a talk on ericas, and they have sampled more than 30% of the ericas, and they are showing that the earlier lineages of erica are sitting in Europe, in the East, in the Northern Temperate, and that Erica arborea in Eastern Africa is older and sister to the ericas that are in the Cape, and that the ericas in the Cape have evolved only in the last 15 million years. The same is unpublished data on Aspalathus. So we can say that the fynbos is both a museum of evolution with old lineages, but also a cradle or hotbed of evolution where many of the fynbos adapted species have evolved and made many species present. What about the succulent Karoo? We all like to go and see the spring flowers, mostly in the family Isoaceae or Mesembryoneaceae being part of it, is found in Africa, but also goes into the Horn of Africa. But most of the species in Rushoidi are in the Cape. And I believe Nikki must have mentioned about Rushoidi in a few days ago. They are adapted to the arid environment in the succulent biome. If you look at their age is mostly younger, about 8 million years. And in a study just comparing sister species which are in the fynbos and in the succulent Karoo, and asking which is older, what's the direction? We find that other than Pelargonium, which seems to have older species in the Karoo, majority of the species in the Karoo that are also in the fynbos, the older part is in the fynbos, and Karoo was subsequently colonized, and species arose further from those colonizations. So in this graph, the white being the succulent Karoo with number of species and the age, we find that they are a lot younger branches of the tree of life in the succulent Karoo than in the fynbos. I started Cyperaceae. If I start telling you what Cyperaceae is, you perhaps say it looks like a restia, it looks like a grass, you don't see it. But after fire, Tetraria thermalis is a member of Cyperaceae. Tetraria and its allied or associated species come up after fire. But if you look at the genus Tetraria, we have it here, we have it in Australia. And we recently completed a study where we were looking at the age of Tetraria and its relatives and its pattern of geography in relation to Australia and other parts of the world where Tetraria and its allies occur. And we find, for one, that Tetraria as a genus does not include all the members of one branch. So in blue is the group which includes Tetraria thermalis, the mountain, the bark palmate, my Afrikaans is not good, and Tetraria capsidata is in a different branch. So here's a case where we have to change the taxonomy. the name Tetraria unfortunately will disappear, because the oldest name Tetraria in this branch also includes Chinas, and Chinas, the type species for Chinas is a Linnaean name, so many of our Tetrarias will become Chinas, and then Tetraria families and relatives will have another name. But if you come to the age and the geography, we find that at about 60 million years, the ancestor was in Australia, the ancestor of all the members of that group. And then we've got recent dispersal into Africa, and Africa is shown in blue, for members of the Kafa group, for Nezembekia, Nezembekia seeds on mountain streams, for Tetraria thamalis, Capybaras, and for the Epshinas group. So five independent events of dispersal from Australia to South Africa into the Fynbos. And those five events have happened in the last 30 million years. And then many of the species that we see, this is in the Utenikwa, where Tetraria involucrata is growing happily after fire, that group has only expanded in the last 10 million years. So by using multiple sources of data, we can be able to put an age to lineages and pattern of dispersal. So coming back to proteas, if you look at the Proteaceae as a group, the ancestor, I think, was in Australia. There has been independent dispersal from Australia to Africa. Some other lineages, like the daisies, have gone from Africa to Australia. So there's multiple dispersal events tracking similar Fynbos like habitat between mainland Africa, Madagascar, Australia, New Zealand, New Caledonia, and even South America. What about fire? You know, 2 weeks ago I went to Gokorat, and there was a huge fire 2 years ago. The whole slope got burned. But talking to Giorgio, he was so excited that there's an orchid which was only collected in 1950 years ago. There's a paper clip here in Cape Agnes. An orchid which was seen 50 years ago has just come up. They thought it was extinct. Fire seemed to be linked, especially to lineages of orchids. And in this study, which looked at the genus Dicer, and asked the question, can we look at the age at which the fire adapted species evolved? It shows that, you know, at about mid-Miocene, 15 to or so million years ago, is when we get the lineages which have adapted fire link. They don't come up unless there's fire. You could go for 50 years, you could go for 100 years, you build up a fire, you go there, one, the first growing season. Second growing season, they are gone. And fire-linked orchids have evolved in the last 15 million years in the day. I've been playing the hoverbug, and this is work in progress. You know, you think of the Ronarsfjord between Napier, Bredasdorp, to the Hoop, and the area to Solendam, and it looks like just farming lands. But within those farming lands, and thanks to the farmers who have allowed us to go in and have kept these patches, you get patches which have not been plowed, which are the top of hills, and you got the soil to them. The lower slopes which are farmed have got clay soils. The upper slopes have got coarse cut landscape. So small pebbles, pebbles of coarse covering those patches. And in them, we described five new species to science earlier last year. You think, you know, 200 kilometers from Cape Town, five new species to science, four of them being legumes, including this beautiful Ortholobium, one being Cyperaceae. And in the same patches, we find other species which are endemic. You know, there's an Isoaceae gibbeum, which is only there. There's an Aligia. And these are botanical biodiversity hotspots. And the question that we'll continue to be continuing with, and I hope that I can fundraise to support that work from NRF and other sources, is to ask the question, are these landscapes representing perhaps an older landscape, which the intervening slopes have been eroded away? And so are these museums preserving ancient lineages? And we hope to use fossil data you can get and use molecular data to ask the question, you know, for the gibbeum which is there, where is it on the tree of life of the gibbeums? Is it an older species or is it young? If we find the gibbeum and the asparagus and the other lineages are old, then we can conclude, we can hypothesize perhaps, I should say, that these landscapes are old and that they should be treated also for other groups to see what other animals and other biodiversity they have. If you find that they are young, then the only explanation will be that they have been a product of erosion to expose these. If you go to the Canex contractor and as you go into the second Karoo, you also get similar quartz fields. And I've been involved in describing new species from those also. So these are within the fynbos, where we think we know everything. There are pockets which still require our attention. And conservation managers can only pay attention once you tell what they have and we tell them how unique it is and how it fits the tree of life. And you know, given limited resources, and you have a taxon which is sitting on its own branch of the tree of life, and you have many others which are part of a young lineage, how would you preserve the older one? That's my justification for saying we need to save the rhino, because the rhino sits on a branch which is fairly removed from other mammals. It's not just a tip. You know, we can lose one antelope and will not lose much biodiversity. In conclusion, I hope I've been able to take you on a safari linking Anusia's talk on when the dinosaurs were roaming this part of Africa, when grasses were sitting perhaps in little ghettos where at their exposure where there was no forest, to what we have today, being these roaring plains teeming with mammals, with grasses and other biodiversity. And by using a combination of techniques from molecular data to ecological traits of plants, we can be able to stock and pass half a glimpse to what has happened to lead to this biodiversity. Asanteni sana.
Thank you very much, Mutama. There's a question already.
Dispersal that you speak about in the last 10 million years between continents. How does it happen?
How does it happen? I wish I could be able to answer that. I wish I could be able to answer on how a little crocodile or a sage, which does not have any feathers or other ways, can grow up between continents. But, you know, I also want to open my imagination and say that there might be uncommon events, but there still could be there where you've got wind blowing between here and Australia. Within the Cyperaceae, I've looked at one lineage choker in wetlands, and it's here in, if you go to silver mine in the dam, the mud forming taxon, Isolepis, you go into each mountain in Africa, there are species, and it goes all the way to Norway. Mm-hmm. And using molecular data, we've been able to demonstrate that it's dispersed from the Cape into the grasslands in the Drakensberg, and using a stepping stone model, gone to Europe. So I can hypothesize for that water birds are responsible. For daisies, I can say they can float in the air and go from one continent to another.
Any other questions?
If Lynn Lyon at one stage in Negotrop had this four different microclimates and biomes, and it was a wonderful museum of all sorts of things. Has that been preserved by Cape Nature? Do you know whether there's any work being done there at present?
I would not talk with authority. Perhaps we would have to note down and follow it up and come back. But I know that Cape Nature has been going into partnership with landowners and the areas in Newhold were visited a couple where there is that partnership and stewardship. But that particular, is it Glen Lyon.
Just outside Nevoetville. Yeah. When Neil McGregor was alive, people came from all around the world, from Kew and Japan and everywhere. I just want to know if it's being retained.
Yes. Thank you. There's a member of the audience who says Glen Lyon is.
If maize and sorghum use C3 photosynthesis and therefore food security is threatened, what uses C4 that could replace something as common as maize?
Okay. Thank you. She's asking if maize and sorghum use C3. I'll correct that. Maize and sorghum and sugarcane use C4 photosynthesis. C3 is in wheat.
Oh, okay.
And we in barley. And you know, in parts of Eastern Africa, with erratic rain and maize being not a reliable crop, there's more of a policy shift to encourage growing of root crops. So cassava, especially, and you can eat cassava leaves as a vegetable, you can eat cassava as a snack, you can eat cassava in pap, except as the varieties that are easy to prepare and less toxic are also susceptible to virus disease. But you know, people need to just perhaps adjust their palates. We all enjoy our bread, but or our pap, but you know, perhaps it's not sustainable.
Okay, there are two questions there.
Where can I get more information about African underground forests? I'm fascinated that the, for instance, the Erythrina, and are there many plants that do that?
African underground forests, where can you find more information?
Yeah, do I just Google underground forest?
Google underground forest, maybe also include Frank White. We'll give additional information, maybe I can post it. Unfortunately, Frank White published that paper in the Singapore Botanical Bulletin. So it's not accessible, but I think I have a PDF of it. It could be one of the literature we put out.
Additional readings. So tomorrow I'm going to try and get the link from Janet, and I'll give you the link that she's going to provide for our class. And so we have a list of additional readings in there.
Isn't the film about the underground forests going to be on today?
Is there?
The film about the underground forests in the extra program.
There may be. It may be. So there is an additional program that's running parallel to this, and they try to source videos and things.
Mm-hmm.
And so apparently there's an underground forest video that's currently going to run.
Last question.
Yeah, question. Yes, you?
Just want to ask, what about TEF as a substitute?
Great.
TEF, what about TEF?
What about the possibility of TEF as a substitute?
TEF is a good one, and I enjoy my injera. But TEF is a grass in the Rabrosia, so it's a C4 grass, but it's one which is being selected for the soils of the Aichi in Ethiopia, which get very wet during the rain season, and it's cropped around that time. And TEF indeed is one of the few sources of flour which has no gluten. So if you want gluten-free bread, TEF is an alternative. It seems to have a narrow range within climate that can grow. But maybe it's one of the crops of the future.
Okay, then no other questions. Thank you very much.